This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
U.S. Electoral College formally confirms Joe Biden's victory over Donald Trump in the presidential election. The U.S. president announces the resignation of Attorney General William Barr weeks after he dismissed Trump's claims of significant voter fraud. Also ahead, the United States coronavirus death toll surpasses 300,000 as the world's worst-hit country kicks off a mass vaccination drive. Good to have you with us. Our top story, U.S. Democratic presidential contender Joe Biden has secured the necessary 270 Electoral College votes to officially become the next president. The votes, which is a formality, has taken extra prominence this year as incumbent President Donald Trump still refuses to concede defeat. Trump said late last month he would leave the White House if the Electoral College voted for Biden. He and his campaign still cast doubt on the fairness of the November 3rd presidential vote. Trump also filed plenty of lawsuits, claiming many votes were cast illegally in swing states. His claims of widespread fraud have also led to street clashes across the country. The election results showed Biden won 306 Electoral College votes. He is due to take office on January the 20th. Political commentator Frank Emspach believes that U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has a difficult path ahead as millions of Americans consider his election victory as illegitimate.
If 40% of the population thinks that the government is illegitimate, which is currently the case here, and that is what President Trump has spent the last 6 weeks doing, then it becomes very, very difficult to lead on any issue. And I believe that President Trump's objective here is to make it almost impossible for President Biden to take initiatives. If President Biden also does not control the Senate, the Republicans are going to do everything they can to impede any initiatives for governance, including going back to the table for the nuclear accords or anything else that President-elect Biden might want to do to ameliorate the situation. And I think for people who want something done, they can go look at, say, 1932 or 33. President Roosevelt, ran as a fiscal conservative. And it was only because there were millions of people demanding Social Security in the streets and people on strike that he moved on these issues. And I think that if there's going to be the kind of widespread reforms that we need in this country, people are going to have to put some energy behind it.
Staying in the U.S., where Attorney General William Barr has resigned just weeks after contradicting President Donald Trump's voter fraud claims. In a tweet, Trump confirmed that Barr will be leaving his job on December the 23rd, just before Christmas, and will be replaced by Deputy Attorney General Jeff Rosen. The announcement came moments after members of the Electoral College formally confirmed Joe Biden as the next U.S. president. Barr has long been seen as one of the Trump's staunchest allies, but his loyalty was in question since he said that a Justice Department investigation had found no sign of major fraud in the November election. Trump's legal team had accused Barr of failing to conduct a proper inquiry into the fraud claims. The coronavirus death toll in the United States has surpassed the grim milestone of 300,000 as the world's hardest hit nation kicks off a mass vaccination program. The vaccinations come at one of the darkest phases of the pandemic as the U.S. confirmed caseload surpasses 16.4 million. The country also registered over 17,000 COVID-related deaths just last week, shattering its previous record and registering the largest number since the virus outbreak. Meanwhile, health officials have warned that infections will continue to rise in the coming weeks due to the holiday season. COVID-19 has also taken a heavy toll on the country's economy, with President Donald Trump facing harsh condemnation for his handling of the pandemic and downplaying its threat to the public. Dwight Reed in Washington, D.C. says the Trump administration's failure to control the coronavirus shows it has failed to give the outbreak a priority.
It's been a really, really horrible year in terms of mainly working people. This is, again, just an absolutely astounding number, 300,000 people, to let that sink in, of course, 109/11s. So when we think about the political priorities that are reflected in this versus what would happen in a catastrophic event like 9/11, I think it tells you a lot about the priorities of the government in place. Of course, we have news that a vaccine is on the way for beginning with primarily with healthcare workers, of course, and residents of long-term facilities. That is what the CDC is recommending, a sort of three-tiered approach for those who will be given priority access. After them would come the other essential workers, with those who are 65 and older making up that sort of 1C prong of the CDC's recommended guidelines. Most states are choosing to follow those. A few of them have modified them slightly. Massachusetts, for instance, is electing to include other vulnerable populations, those who are incarcerated, those who are jailed, and homeless populations as well will be included on the priority list that very first doses are oriented towards.
Elsewhere, COVID-19 infections and deaths keep surging in Europe, where authorities are imposing stringent restrictions to curb the pandemic ahead of the holiday season. Italy registered 491 coronavirus-related deaths and over 12,000 new infections in 24 hours. The government is weighing new restrictions during the New Year holidays to prevent a possible spike in infections in January. Meanwhile, the UK reported over 16,000 new cases of COVID-19 with 232 deaths. British officials say London will be placed under the country's toughest restrictions following a sharp rise in daily cases and hospital admissions in the capital.
Mr. Speaker, these restrictions will come into force at midnight on Wednesday morning, because when the virus moves quickly, we must move quickly too, and we must take the actions that are not necessarily easy, but are effective. Now, I know that this is difficult news, and I know that it will mean plans disrupted, and that for businesses affected, it will be a significant blow. But this action is absolutely essential, not just to keep people safe, but because we've seen early action can help prevent more damaging and longer lasting problems later.
Elsewhere in Europe, Germany has also reported over 16,000 new daily cases and 188 new deaths. The country will go into a partial lockdown from Wednesday until January the 10th. In Turkey, the government has announced a four-day lockdown on the New Year holidays to avert a new spike in coronavirus infections. Earlier this month, Turkey imposed nationwide weekend lockdowns and daily evening curfews to contain a second wave of the pandemic. Another deadline for negotiations about a post-Brexit trade deal has come and gone. The sticking points now are access to UK fishing waters for EU vessels and corporate economic fair play rules. Bayan Karahimi tells us more.
More than 4 years since Britain voted by 52 to 48% to leave the EU, a trade deal is yet to be reached. after it became clear that the UK is hurtling towards a no-deal Brexit, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said Sunday the two sides are still very far apart on some key issues, but the UK will not be leaving the negotiating table.
What I'll say is I think that the UK should continue to try. And I think that's what the people of this country would want me to do. We're going to continue to try.
Mr. Johnson also called on Britain to get ready to trade on World Trade Organization terms. The UK will also have to decide whether to accept the mini-deals proposed by Brussels to keep planes in the air and lorries with food and medicines rolling. A no-deal might mean rising food prices and the loss of 300,000 jobs. So are Britons worried?
There's scary things like there might not be food on the shelves, like in January and February, because it's going to be a nightmare getting everything through customs. There's the whole Irish border thing. I mean, I can just go on and on and on.
I think, you know, leaving the European Union is a very, very bad idea. I think the decision was probably made by the old people, and the young people have to cope with it in the future.
Boris has let everybody down, left, right and centre. He promised the earth, he promised this ready cooked deal, and he's just not delivered in any shape or form. It's dreadful. But on the other hand, we can't be blackmailed by Europe.
Preventing a deal is a row over Britain's fisheries. After January 1st, Europe won't have automatic access to British waters anymore, and a no deal will mean zero access. The French are particularly upset about this. Clashes in the English Channel are likely, and the UK has already bolstered its defences there with four Royal Navy ships. The EU is calling for calm, though.
Great Britain and Europe are friends, partners, allies, and this will remain the case after Brexit.
The EU's Brexit negotiator is also calling for patience, saying a new trade pact with Britain is still possible this week.
Trade of goods and services, fishing, energy, transport, security of citizens. Never have we negotiated such an agreement in such a short space of time. We've only been negotiating for 9 months.
The EU says that Westminster has to compromise on fisheries, but the UK says it cannot be the only country in the world that does not have sovereign control over its fishing waters. Neither seem prepared to budge, and despite a new deadline, it seems a no-deal Brexit is more and more likely. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The United States has imposed sanctions on Turkey over its purchase of the Russian S-400 missile defense system. The sanctions targeted a major Turkish defense procurement and development body, as well as its president and three employees. The Turkish foreign ministry condemned the move as inexplicable, warning that Ankara will retaliate as necessary. Anti-Turkey measures also drew condemnations from Moscow, with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov calling them another manifestation of an arrogant attitude towards international law. He noted that the U.S. has been pursuing its illegitimate and unilateral measures for years. Ankara, a NATO member, acquired the Russian S-400 missiles in mid-2019. NATO claims the defense system poses a threat to the alliance. Turkey's move led to its removal from the U.S. F-35 jet program last year. And the U.S. has imposed sanctions on two Iranians over allegations that they were involved in the 2007 disappearance of Robert Levinson, a former FBI agent. Washington has for long been alleging that Levinson was abducted from Iran's Kish Island and most likely died in captivity. Tehran has categorically denied any involvement in his disappearance and said it has done its utmost to find any evidence pointing to Levinson's exact fate. This is the first time the U.S. has accused Iran of direct involvement in the case. The sanctions are the latest in a long series of anti-Iran measures U.S. President Donald Trump has taken under his so-called maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. The United States has formally rescinded Sudan's status as a state sponsor of terrorism following an agreement in October. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program.
Hello, welcome to the News Review. The U.S. has officially announced its decision to remove Sudan from a list of state sponsors of terrorism. In a statement, the American Embassy in Khartoum said the Secretary of State has signed a notification that is effective from Monday. In October, the U.S. President Donald Trump announced that he was delisting Sudan from the blacklist. That after the African country agreed to normalize ties with Israel in a Washington brokered deal. Sudan also agreed to pay $335 million to compensate for the 1998 terror attacks on U.S. embassies in Kenya and in Tanzania. Later, Sudan's information minister revealed that Trump wanted to use Sudan as an election card by pressuring it to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. Abayomi Ezekiwe is editor of Pan-African Newswire, who joins us from Detroit. We did have an interview with the information minister of Sudan, who said that the U.S. President Donald Trump actually brokered this deal to play it as an election card. Of course, we see how that turned out for Trump in terms of the elections. But when it comes to Sudan, do you think that it was under pressure to normalize ties in exchange for, like, getting off that terrorism list and, of course, paying that over $300 million?
It's quite obvious. It was a deal that was struck under duress by the outgoing Trump administration. It will not do anything to improve the conditions of the Sudanese people. The current interim Sovereign Council has been reliant upon Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates for financial support. And the fact that they've agreed to pay over $300 million to alleged victims inside the United States clearly shows this is absolutely unacceptable as far as the Sudanese people are concerned. The people in Sudan do not have that type of money to turn over to the most wealthiest capitalist country in the world. So it's no question about it that Sudan has been pressured, and other countries in Africa have also been pressured to, quote, normalize, unquote, relations with the state of Israel.
You know, we're looking at probably a lame duck president at this point, with Donald Trump probably not going to be in office in January. And we're also looking at a government that's in transition in Sudan. The U.S. is known for backing out of deals, and this transitional government, in a sense, how can it really speak for an incoming government? So aren't those two sticking points in this whole thing?
Most definitely. And the interim arrangement in Sudan has tremendous problems. Al-Burhan, who is supposed to be the chair of the Sovereign Council, announced several days ago that he was creating a new structure, a new interim structure. So the situation is clearly in transition in the United States. It depends on the solidarity movement in this country, whether or not these type of arrangements are going to be able to go forward. And I believe that the fundamental problem here is that the Trump administration is attempting to build some type of legacy in regard to the status of the state of Israel in Africa and also in West Asia. And this is clearly not something that's going to benefit the people. For example, Egypt. Egypt normalized relations over 40 years ago with the state of Israel, and the people there are still suffering from poverty and underdevelopment. There's a lack of democracy inside of Egypt. So these agreements mean very little for the overwhelming majority of the people who live in these states.
Thank you so much for that. Abiyu Azakiwi there, editor of the Pan-African Newswire. Many thanks. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in.
That wraps up our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
Percent of Brazil's 211 million citizens identify as black or brown. But last year, nearly 80% of those killed by police officers and 75% of murder victims were black. One of the most recent victims was João Alberto Silveira Freitas, a 40-year-old father of four who was beaten to death by security guards outside a Carrefour supermarket in Porto Alegre on the eve of Brazil's Black Awareness Day. That horrific attack, which was caught on camera, sparked street protests in several major Brazilian cities and was compared to the killing of George Floyd in the United States. Flavia Oliveira, a prominent black broadcaster, called such killings part of the toxic legacy of slavery in a country that was the last Western nation to abolish the practice in May of 1888. Brazil's failure to offer education, land, or compensation to hundreds of thousands of newly emancipated slaves meant that more than 130 years later, profound inequalities persisted, with black Brazilians earning less, living worse, and being killed more often than their white counterparts. We now present you an article written by Tom Phillips under the heading, Killing of Two Girls Stokes Outrage Over Brazil's Horrific Toll of Black Lives. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Tom Phillips's article. The shooting of two young black girls who had between them enjoyed fewer than 11 years of life has sparked outrage in Brazil and intensified the debate over police violence and structural racism in a country still grappling with the legacy of slavery. Emily Victoria Moreira dos Santos and Rebecca Beatriz Rodriguez Santos, cousins aged 4 and 7, were killed on Friday night, 4th of December, as they played outside their grandmother's home in Barro Vermelho, a red brick favela on Rio de Janeiro's rundown northern fringe. Their deaths took the number of children killed in Rio de Janeiro this year to 8, nearly all of them black, like most Brazilian murder victims. Emily's mother, Ana Lucia Silva Moreira, who believes police were responsible for the shooting, vowed, "I feel crushed, but I'm going to find the strength to fight for Emily, for Rebecca, and for all the other girls, because black lives matter." She added, "I wasn't raising my daughter so she could become part of a statistic." Witnesses claimed they had seen a police officer shoot into the community at about 8:30 p.m. local time that night, although Rio's military police has denied its agents opened fire. As the victim's uncle, André da Silva Moreira, and his sister relived the crime on Monday morning, 7th of December, in a plaza near their home in the city of Duque de Caxias, he said, "It's because they're cowards." Ana Lucia, a 38-year-old street hawker, cut in, "And because we're black too." André asked, "You know what rights we have in this country," adding, "The right to become a slab of meat in the hands of our governors." Shootings, part of a remorseless wave of infant deaths in a city awash with high-caliber rifles, sparked an immediate outcry. Former Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff slammed the veritable carnage being unleashed in Rio de Janeiro's poorest communities by the police's utter lack of control. The black philosopher Jamila Ribeiro declared, "This is a genocidal country." One of the most moving protests came from Thiago Amparo, a black public intellectual. He wrote in the Folha de Sao Paulo, "There comes a point where tears can no longer express our pain, demanding who will answer for the genocide that is underway." On Sunday, 6th of December, scores of mourners and activists gathered in Duque de Caxias carrying dolls smothered with fake blood and banners reading, "Stop killing us," and "Vidas Negras Importam," Black Lives Matter. Rio de Janeiro's acting governor, Claudio Castro, promised a rigorous inquiry into the deaths and said he favored a security policy that was based on intelligence and sought to protect lives. Cecilia Oliveira, a public security specialist and journalist, said the killings captured perfectly the futility and racial bias of Brazil's unceasing war on drugs, which claims thousands of mostly black lives each year. Oliveira said, "What happened to those two children in a predominantly black and poor neighborhood far from the center of Rio de Janeiro is the synthesis of what Brazil chose as its public security policy, the extermination of invisible and quote-unquote undesirable people." Official statistics make clear the bloodshed's racial skew. 56% of Brazil's 211 million citizens identify as black or brown. But last year, nearly 80% of those killed by police officers and 75% of murder victims were black. One of the most recent victims was João Alberto Silveira Freitas, a 40-year-old father of four who was beaten to death by security guards outside a Carrefour supermarket in Porto Alegre on the eve of Brazil's Black Awareness Day. That horrific attack, which was caught on camera, sparked street protests in several major Brazilian cities and was compared to the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in the United States. Flavia Oliveira, a prominent black broadcaster, called such killings part of the toxic legacy of slavery in a country that was the last Western nation to abolish the practice in May of 1888. Brazil's failure to offer education, land, or compensation to hundreds of thousands of newly emancipated slaves meant that more than 130 years later, profound inequalities persisted, with black Brazilians earning less, living worse, and being killed more often than their white counterparts. Oliveira said Brazil remains a country that is built on the privileges of white people. Oliveira, the security specialist, said she had no doubt about the racial dimension of the slaying of João Alberto, Emily, and Rebecca. Spurning recent claims from the country's vice president, Hamilton Mourão, that racism did not exist, Oliveira said, "What these cases tell us in such brazen, crystal-clear terms is that black lives do not matter in Brazil." Relatives of Emily and Rebecca also scoffed at Vice President Hamilton Mourão's remarks as they gathered to demand justice for the girls who were shot in the head and chest and whose final moments are too horrifying to describe. Recalling how she had bought Emily a beautiful toy for the party they had planned, Ana Lucia Silva Moreira said of her daughter, "She was going to turn 5 years old on 23rd of December. Instead, she was buried in it on Saturday afternoon, 5th of December, in a tatty concrete grave." Rebecca's grandmother, Lydia da Silva Moreira Santos, said she had just returned home from a 12-hour shift at the hospital, where she cleans a COVID-19 ward. When she heard gunfire, she was adamant came from police. The 51-year-old said, "She was my only granddaughter, my flesh and blood, and they took her from me in the most ridiculous, cruel, and brutish way possible. They didn't have the right to do that," adding, "It's insane, just insane." The two girls smiled out from Santos's white t-shirt, printed in memory of youngsters she considered her princesses. The tribute below read, "Emily and Rebecca, Words cannot express the sadness I feel right now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان العين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, dear brothers and sisters. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. And welcome to the program of Islamic Upbringing, here on IRIB English Radio. In this program, we discuss the problems and questions that parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. And the answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmi Aqum. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Brother Miqdad.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Brother Miqdad, one of our listeners, they're having a question. Let me read it out for you. It says that I'm going to be a mentor at an Islamic camp for 10-year-olds. Could you give me some tips on how to have positive effects on these Muslim children? What do you have to say about it, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There's a lot to be said regarding mentors, and perhaps requires a much more detailed discussion. But just a couple of points that come to mind right now. The role of mentors for children is extremely, extremely influential. Uh-huh. Little children, especially children that are at the age of 9, 10, 11, they really look up to their mentors, mm-hmm. People that they spend time with, especially in places like Islamic camps. And this is just a reminder for our communities to make sure that they actually strengthen these courses, these camps that happen perhaps throughout the year or mostly in summer, mm-hmm. Where children get together and go to a particular place where whether it's a weekend or a week or 2 weeks, yeah. And they spend time with mentors and teachers, learning about different things at the same time, doing sports and activities, mm-hmm. and away from the family, basically. Yeah. These are very, very impactful in the life of a young child. And the role of mentors in that is extremely, extremely powerful, and we need to be very careful. So first and foremost is really to pray to Allah and ask Allah's help for this, because any impact that you will have on this will actually be very impactful. It's not something that we can take lightly. Uh-huh. So inshallah, we pray to Allah. We go into this camp with a lot of sincerity, with a lot of dua, a lot of tawassul to the Ahlul Bayt, that Allah can help us basically to make sure that we have the right impact on these children. So, yeah. Inshallah, through sincerity, we can achieve a lot. The second point is to keep in mind that children will learn more from what they see than what they hear. Uh-huh. So, the way we behave, not just in relation to children, but generally, the way we mm-hmm. behave is often more impactful than what we teach them through our words. Mm-hmm. And so as a mentor, it's very important to always be careful of our actions. That, yeah.
So
how you behave.
Children learn from their elders.
Exactly. They learn when they see. If you want to teach a child, for example, to pray on time, right? There's one way we can have a whole class about the importance of praying on time, etc. But there's a better way is to actually be there on time for namaz.
Yeah, that's right.
For you're playing football, having loads of fun, adhan's coming, you stop the game and say, I'm going to pray, it's time for prayers. Children will follow because they have respect for you. And so this is very crucial that we need to show in our actions that what we want to teach them. So basically preach by actions.
So basically actions create a lot of impact on children.
Definitely. Another point is to build a very strong relationship with your mentees. The closer this relationship, the closer the impact, the stronger the impact will be. Now this relationship is built through a lot of respect, a lot of discussion, friendly discussions, but also doing things with them. So whether it's playing sports with them, whether it's sitting down and having dinner and lunch with them, basically as a mentor you should be with them throughout the adventures that they go through. Even though sometimes if it means that something you've never done in your life and you might even be weak at it. For example, remember we had mentors that have never played football in their lives, right? But just for the sake of the camp, it's okay, put some shoes on and put some tracksuit bottoms on and play football, even though you don't know how to kick a ball. And it's okay if you get laughed a little bit. It shows that you're part with the camp, basically.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Brother Miqdad. And dear listeners, we'll be right back after a short break.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
So welcome back to your audience, and we're discussing about how to create a relationship with children. So Brother Miqdad, please continue.
So the more close our relationship, the more we become a role model for children, right? Because children actually count you as amongst them, but at the same time, successful, at the same time older, at the same time better than them. So they actually count you as a kind of a role model. And this is a very important place because then they look at everything you do as well.
Yeah,
it's interesting, once a scholar was saying that between the Dhuhr namaz and the Asr namaz, he removed his watch whilst he was praying because he was sweating, it was really hot. After the Asr Salah, he realized that everybody else has taken their watch out.
Yeah.
Because they were just copying, basically. They were looking exactly at what the scholar is doing, and they were following exactly what he was doing. So this is how we become.
So our actions do really matter.
Definitely. So we need to be careful, basically. So that requires us to be careful what we do. One important thing is to realize that when we become role models, always try to then be an intermediary for the real role models. Because we've talked about many times that the real models are the Ahlul Bayt for us, right? And so when you become a role model, your duty is to actually say, you know what, I'm a role model, but I'm just an intermediary for you to take the Ahlul Bayt as role models. So if you like something in me, always attribute it back to the Ahlul Bayt, right? So what they realize that this person is my role model, is doing this. I like him a lot. He's doing this. But he's told me that this is what the Ahlul Bayt used to do. And so actually, they actually fall in love with the Ahlul Bayt ultimately.
That's right.
Another point to consider, to be careful of is, when it comes to difficulties that will come in the course, whether it's through events that are, for example, there was a mistake done, or for example, there was a fight, or for example, you wanted children to pray on time, but they weren't praying on time, or correcting things, we need to be careful because obviously the role of the mentor is to make sure the camp runs very right. smoothly and that there's no issues, and when there is issue to try and solve them.
Yeah.
We should be very careful as mentors to ensure that we give reminders at the right time, and mm-hmm. we do something called taghaful at the right time as well. Mm-hmm. A lot of the issues can be solved through ignoring, especially when times when children have realized their mistake. You know, for example, let's say they had a fight between themselves. Mm-hmm. Okay, there was a fight, maybe a bit of tears, things got broken, for example. At times, you can just ignore it.
Yeah.
Or very indirect reminder, right?
Yeah.
Because they know themselves the mistake, right? To go and point out the finger, oh, you did this bad thing and you did that bad thing, you shouldn't have done this, what lesson do you learn from this? It's actually aggravating the situation, right? Now, mm-hmm. it was unnecessary to do that. We knew our mistake, just ignore it. And when you ignore it, what happens is the children actually, their self-respect remains, basically. They don't feel embarrassed, because once you point them out, say, you made this mistake, now they count themselves as, you know what, my role model that I had as a role model now counts me very less. He doesn't respect me anymore.
Yeah.
My self-image has been tampered. And this actually will hamper and make it more difficult for you to work with them. So many a times, it's important to do taghaful, to ignore it. And when we do give reminders, we should be careful when do we give reminders and what kind of reminders we give.
Thank you so much, Brother Maghdad. And dear audience, thank you so much for staying with us. Do not go anywhere, because we'll be right back after a short break.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "He who has a child must treat him in a childish manner."
So welcome back, dear audience, and we were discussing about how a person can be a good mentor for children. So, Brother Maghdad, I would like you to continue.
Well, we give reminders, always stick to reminders that are related to wajib and haram. Don't go into things that are mustahab, for example, or makruh, for example. Stick to, I'm talking about Islamic reminders, right?
Yeah.
Stick to things that are wajib and haram, and be as less harsh as possible. Remember, tarbiyah or having impact on children is an internal impact, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want them to adopt a certain action only for the period of the course. Yeah. That's a pointless goal.
Yeah.
For example, you want to teach them to pray on time,
mm-hmm.
right? There's one where we can have loads of rewards for those who pray on time during the next week, for example. The mm-hmm. course is a one-week course. The person who prays on time throughout the 7 days will get this reward, and if you don't pray on time, you'll get this punishment.
Yeah.
Now, what this will do is it will only make them change for 7 days. After that, when they go back home, they'll be the same.
Yeah.
Right? They won't change anything. What you want to do in these 7 days is to change them inside.
Mm-hmm.
That from within, they want to pray on time. Mm-hmm. That even when they go home, there's no reward, there's no punishment, they've still got this change within them that they want to pray on time. And so this happens through role modeling, this happens through teaching them the importance of things, this happens through making them enjoy it, making them enjoy, for example, sitting together and discussing intellectual discussion, asking questions and discussing and debating, reading a book, for example, praying, make prayers very attractive, make recitation of the Adhan, for example, very beautiful, make the Quran sessions very interesting.
Yeah.
These things actually make an internal change within them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a big difference between discipline, where you want the camp to run very smoothly, everybody has recited their Quran, everybody has prayed on time, but this will not have any effect, because after the course, when the rewards and punishment are gone, they're back to normal life, nothing has changed. You want to have an internal change. When they go back home, they actually will carry on doing the things that you want them to do. So very important to know how to give these changes, know how to make Islamic principles or Islamic rituals very, very attractive, very, very pleasurable, very, very amazing, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The best mentors, for example, are those who are able to create an amazement towards the Quran. That you want this child to go back home and says, one thing I learned from the course is how amazing this Quran is, right? Or, for example, to teach them about the importance of salah and to make them enjoy salah, or to make them enjoy dua, for example. or simply to teach them how beautiful Islam is in terms of its impact on both the physical aspect and on the and the spiritual aspect. I learned that Islam encourages to do sport and to be clean and to shower every day and to make sure we're presentable. At the same time, Islam teaches us to pray and to fast and to give charity. So be very careful how we present Islam. There's a lot to say. Last point, I know time is running short, is if there's a lot of mentors together working together, it's very important that you're always on the same page, you don't contradict one another, that you're working very well in synchrony, and that the relationship that you're showing with one another, the respect that you're showing one another, is very crucial, because children look at that as well. They see your behavior with other mentors as well, and how you talk to them and what you say between each other, and this will have an impact on their own friend circle and how they behave between themselves as well.
So thank you so much, Brother Miqdad. In this program, we're talking about how we can be good mentor for children. So dear listeners, this was your host, Hassanain, and thank you for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. And until another program, God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
When the heads of state of 14 nations sat down together in late 2018 to discuss the grim condition of the world's oceans, there was no certainty that anything consequential would result. The leaders planned 14 gatherings, but met only twice before the pandemic upended their talks. So when the group announced recently the world's most far-reaching pact to protect and sustain ocean health, it signaled a bit more than a noteworthy achievement in a complicated time. The agreement, negotiated by the nuance-free tool of video conferencing, also offered hope of a renewed era of global accord on climate, where issues grounded in science might finally trump political posturing. Stay with us for an article written by Laura Parker, an expert in climate change and marine environment. The piece is titled, In Rare Show of Solidarity, 14 Key Nations Commit to Protect Oceans. Overall, the 14 leaders agreed to sustainably manage 100% of the oceans under their national jurisdictions by 2025, an area of ocean roughly the size of Africa. Additionally, they vowed to set aside 30% of the seas as marine protected areas by 2030, in keeping with the United Nations campaign known as 30 by 30. Both of those large commitments, the leader said, will help end overfishing and illegal fishing, rebuild declining fish stocks, halt the flow of plastic waste into the seas, and clean up dead zones created by runoff from the farm waste. Nancy Norton, a marine scientist emeritus at the Smithsonian Institution, who was not involved in the project, says, "What I find really interesting is that 14 nations spent the last 2 years talking to each other in an experiment you'd like to see more of in the future. They are working together as a team, starting with countries on the same page provides a mechanism for actually achieving success. The 14 members are Australia, Canada, Chile, Ghana, Indonesia, Japan, Kenya, Mexico, Namibia, Norway, Portugal, and the island nations of Fiji, Jamaica, and Palau. Combined, they represent 40% of the world's coastlines, 30% of the offshore exclusive economic zones, 20% of the world's fisheries, and 20% of the world's shipping fleet." Vidar Helgesen, Norway's former Minister of Climate and Environment and a driving force behind the project, says, "Negotiations with that category of country isn't all that easy. We decided to get a group where high politics wouldn't get in the way and we could be focused on the task." The idea, Vidar Helgesen says, was to gather a coalition of the willing, a like-minded group of countries with the ocean deeply embedded in their culture and history, to conduct discussions that will be underpinned by science. Consequently, the high-level panel for a sustainable ocean economy includes nations large and small, rich and poor, spread across all ocean basins. All are economically dependent to various degrees on the seas and oceans. The 14 leaders are now inviting other nations to join the effort. The effort was backed up by a team of 253 scientists that conducted new ocean research and published 16 authoritative papers on topics ranging from an assessment of stemming the flow of plastic waste to combating climate change. The members of the high-level panel also were willing to turn conventional thinking on its ear. Instead of considering the ocean as merely a victim of climate change, which it undoubtedly is, at its both warming and acidifying, the leaders say the seas should be harnessed to become part of the global solution. The key to that is to take an all-in approach, sustainably managing 100% of the oceans, not just the protected areas. Properly managed, the panel says, the ocean economy, including fishing, can expand. Additionally, actions such as restoration of mangroves, kelp beds, and seagrasses that absorb carbon could help offset global emissions by as much as a fifth and help hold global warming to 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit or 1.5 degrees Celsius, the leaders say. Jane Lubchenco, who co-chaired the high-level panel's expert committee, says, "We have acted as if we had to choose between protecting the ocean or using it. That's a false choice. We're discovering smarter ways to use the ocean without using it up. The secret lies in protecting the health of the ocean ecosystems." She says the solutions offered by the panel could generate 40 times more renewable energy through development of offshore wind energy production and wave and tidal power, and lift millions of people out of poverty. The panel's economists forecast that every $1 spent invested in a sustainable ocean would return $5 in economic, social, and environmental benefits. The solutions involve a range of 74 actions, some already in progress. New technologies, for example, enabled Ghana to track foreign fishing vessels lurking off its coast and crack down on illegal fishing, while the panel's call for investment in sewage and waste management infrastructure to curb the flow of plastic waste into the seas. It's prohibitively expensive and unlikely to happen on a large scale in the coming decades. Many developing nations have banned various single-use plastic products, and others are deploying catchment systems on major rivers in Thailand, for example. Also in Vietnam and Indonesia, to capture plastic waste before it is disgorged into the seas. If the approach sounds to some like just another blue ribbon exercise in futility, the leaders say the time for small steps has passed. The ocean, which covers 70% of the globe and produces more than half of the oxygen on Earth, has reached such a dire point of decline that more drastic action is needed now. The world's decade-long inability to rebuild dwindling fish stocks to feed a growing world population offers a timeline that strikingly illustrates the point. Fishing reached peak catch in the mid-1990s, marking the beginning of a long decline. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warned in a special 2019 report on fragile ocean health that without action, fish could decrease by 25% by 2100. Henrik Sala, a marine scientist and National Geographic explorer in residence, says, "No way is applying more effort to fishing going to get us more fish. Likewise, setting aside small slivers of ocean for protection, just 7% of the seas are designated marine protected areas, will not restore ocean health. Even 30% is not considered enough." At the same time, the phrase sustainably managed is such a broad, elusive term that it opens the door wide for skepticism. Daniel Pauly, a world-renowned fisheries expert at the University of British Columbia in Canada, who was not associated with the project, praised the effort, but he remains dubious of the notion that the term sustainably managed has any meaningful impact. Daniel Pauly says, "Most of the public doesn't know that sustainable doesn't mean abundant. You can sustain any level, including low levels. You can sustain a stock that is overfished." On the other hand, less skeptics dismiss the idea that just 14 of the world's 192 coastal nations could make an impact. Consider that Japan, a powerful influence in the Asia-Pacific, signed onto the agreement to set aside 30% of the oceans in marine protected areas. The fact that Japan, which has long signaled reluctance to create protected areas, has changed course is a big deal, according to Sala. Now, when the United Nations meets next year in China to continue work on a global marine protection treaty that still eludes adoption, having Japan on board in support of marine protected areas may ease the way for other nations to reconsider.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.